Construction Battle Inc. versus PSC. It's case number 02-31863. Attorney Flanagan, you have 25 minutes, and Attorney Rantham, 22, and Attorney Lacombe, 8 minutes, and you're going to have 5 minutes. You may proceed.
Good morning, this is Norman Hale, Justice of the Supreme Court. This is the law firm of Michael Bessin, pre-reg. Our reference is about the petition in this case. Stephen Smith, Steve Butler, was in house counsel in the city, and also heard one of you also today. I'm going to look at some copies of the blow-ups that we argued for the court. And I would ask the permission of the court if you could approach the bench and please provide copies.
Is there any objection?
Plenary standard is used by the parties in this case. Once you understand the undisputed facts, this is not the case being only looking about, which is that the commission is looking for them to order a refund of money collected under a properly filed tariff. If the commission settlement finds one of the ways in that tariff to be unlawful, our position is that section 196.3715 bars the refund. The state involves direct and substantive payment to a rate itself, thereby invoking section 196.3-1, which has been consistently interpreted by this court as prohibiting the PSC from ordering refunds. If the PSC's and carrier's arguments that since the third is provided in 196.372, that they have been called to the services, not rate, and not technical rule, but a substantive dispute over the rate itself.
Well, the argument of your opposing counsel is that it does apply, and it would cover this. The argument they're saying is that because it was unlawful at the beginning, in other words, at its inception, that it would be covered under two. What is your response?
Section 1 also provides that it covers unlawful rates. Section 2 covers unlawful acts and services. Section 1 has no timing requirement in it. Once the rate is found to be unlawful, you are fine. My instructions are elaborated in that further today. But clearly, Section 1 applies for it. There is no timing element in it. Okay. We also find in Client 4 from the statutes like 196 and 2194A that this court in the long run question of the Kimberly Court case to say that all reasonable doubts must be exercised next to the Client 4, where it's not stated in the statute. And the court rejected in Section 5-4, where it found in Kimberly Park that the power was not requested or paid in the statute. In that case, it was construing a statute not to go from 196.371. But let me briefly summarize the fact for you, Your Honor. That's what I think starts to look.
Jordan's going to help me out in terms of that.
The long-distance carrier is the access to our network. If you take the call, they ask us to provide a commercial tariff, which is basically to amend this service that we provide at this return. Well, this is what the charge for the rates will be. In this case, obviously, we will charge a number of rates, including a commercial rate. I'm going to explain how we can be covered times here. This is the 1994 statute was passed in Wisconsin. It's a chapter of the statute 196 and 196. It required us to
one of those called the Carrier Line Fund.
We are faced with the issue of not whether it's unlawful, as the Court of Appeals was, but if it is unlawful, what can the remedy, the scope of the remedy? What relevance are these facts that you are now putting forth for ultimately context?
Context and also the argument presented in the overriding thing, which I'll get to in a minute, that in both the PSCs and the outcomes of the carrier treaty, that somehow it seems to look at me really need to be historic. Just the thing of part is just to simply point out the fact of the information that in 1997, we cracked one of these cells. We call the access to the register. There was no dispute about the access to the register. We had a $16 million. In 1997, all of us, I think, knew that it was not the and the huge cost of the local system. In 1998, we followed this STCA, which you can do under the same. And in fact, we implemented a document which was the FDIC, and we charged in total $36.6 million. So in 1997 and 1998, prior to the FDIC, we charged $36.6 million. But in 1998, we charged $36.6 million in excess. So when the FDIC matter is still that engaged here,
you're not contesting the conclusion of the Circuit Court here in the Court of Appeals with regard to it was unlawful.
We're not contesting that. They found it to be lawful. It's lawful. 186.371 by the press principle. After we instituted the recommendation, they found that. In an informal proceeding, the PSC originally approved it because we were aware that we were coming in the statute and statute. And after that, at the end of 1998, they filed a formal challenge to the rate and claimed that the PSC found that the rate was both unlawful and the Supreme Court. Now, the last part where it was really the petition in question and discussing it during the presentation today. Before I get to the detail of the polls here, however, I do want to briefly address what I call the open room and I refer to it in my answer to your question, which is that somehow Wisconsin Dells is being at home company. It must be invented on the square to build that convenience. My argument for me, as I point out to you, there's new unrealized or realist writing here in 1998 is the same as 1997.
I'm not so much interested in your comment as I am in the authority that you're telling me the PSC does not throw out. Order this refund. Can you focus your argument a little bit on
that? Yes. Well, if we go to the statute itself, in this case, 1.3.7.1 will correct the fix. The first requirement is what's going to be the solution. Under the statute, I don't think there's any dispute that an investigation proof here is correct. The PC needs to notice the proceedings called an investigation. It's pointed out in our reply that the error itself in several cases is called an investigation. In this court's jurisdiction, it said one of the cases, 1.6.2, which is the same investigatory CFP in the chat room and the also, obviously, there was
the extension of the statement back on the interior section 591 definition of the investigation and investigation procedure. Next requirement is to determine that the arrestor charge is unlawful. Well, first, is there a later charge? If it seems right for a charge. And in fact, that's the 15th on page 73. All we had to do to implement it was to get a new system or follow up proper procedures and doing so. The next question is it unlawful or discriminatory? And clearly, that's what the PC found here. So the only question at that point is, well, yeah, well, PC can file, can order with, can be filed and approved in the future. And in the WPL, with Mr. Collins, which is in the Kimberly Park and Sixth Court, has stated that what that language means is that you can tell them to compel a case in the future, which can order a refund.
And what's the difference between sub 1 and sub 2 of this statute?
Right. We have in sub 1 a rate that is taken. In sub 2, there is no language. There is no rate. In this case, the statute prohibited a contrary non-article substitute. The previous simple level essentially revolves around what is substitute. It needs to administer the rate itself. It has to define, because the next place there could be a defined term, the two basically setting and defining what substitute means. And you look at in great detail what the 60 charge is all about. So clearly, it was a scheme about a way. There is nothing in substitute that's a scheme about this.
But read it. As I understood your argument, that you would then say
two
guilty services, is that correct?
Services are
fast,
yes.
But let's take a look at the language then of sub 2. It says, if the commission finds that any practice or act is unlawful, well, isn't that what we have here, a determination? That what was done by your
client
was unlawful?
Right, they said what we did was unlawful, but it wasn't a practice, or it wasn't a practice.
It wasn't an act, the act of tell me why it wasn't an act.
Well, if you dispute the evidence of the movement, what happens is any unreasonable or any discriminatory or any unlawful rate can all be characterized, if you want to, as an act of charging a discriminatory rate, an act of charging unlawful rate. What it does is you just basically write 196 to 371 right out of the book. There's a strong public policy for 186.271, which is not defining the rate, the utility is entitled to revenue certainty going forward. Of course, that doesn't protect consumers too. Because we can, for example, in this case, going back to my first chart, we charge only part of the tax rate. We wanted to keep the revenues even between the 1997 and 1998 years. Let's say the PCP back and down to the PCP rate was a model. But we could have gone back to that and said, we do charge for the future, but we cannot do that under the public policy of the statute. So we change it to set that public policy to protect utilities' revenues once they file the rates, which the first thing we do. We did it. We complied with the law in terms of filing the rates.
It's defined in many verses.
One of these 16371 is not in the books. For years.
I believe the early part of the 19th, the 20th century, is when blood test.
I think the bill was 1996.
1996 was passed in 1993. I think it came out in 1994.
And the bill was 1996 really contemplated a whole different measure of regulation.
In the sense that at that point, we followed the federal rate. That's what was anticipated. Interestingly enough, if the legislature knew that PSC had any kind of authority, you would have seen it in 1996. There is no such any kind of authority in that statute in the future of the court that would have to be responsible.
Well, you see, when you go to created by something.
This picture could describe your son terribly, and that's what we began charging in 1998.
All of it is that seems to me traditionally mirrored the federal interstate rate. And then all of a sudden, the feds put state charge on it, and you couldn't impose it simply because of the limitations.
Well, that was one. That was the excuse for this case. We absolutely believe, given what we need to do here, but particularly was much different in the comparative nature. And in fact, one of the issues that we face in this case is that if we do have some sort of revenue protection going forward, and we can support policy further with passing power and others, and draw away the 1.6371, our revenues in all these, there's going to be potentially in the future of the FCC, different ways. And if they have an issue with a certain thing, the intention of the PSC, certainly, I think we're entitled to that revenue protection. But is it a rate we found unreasonable, or just a rate we found somehow discriminatory? And there are many issues from 371 if the CFO plans to go ahead with principles. But clearly, under 1.6372, it does not.
Well, but you have to be assessed here by him because looking at the two subsections, what about the 14th argument starting on page 12, I think page 34 of this brief, that what you're doing with in sub 1 is really the legislative authority of Wisconsin law, and sub 2 deals more with the enforcement aspect. And you can do that consistent with what Justice Prosser referred to in 196 sub 2 of it. It talks about in sub 4 and enforcement. Can't you read your statutes in that
fashion? I don't see any where that distinction is made in the statutes, whether they're acting under enforcement in your legislative capacity.
Telephone company versus FCC.
In that particular case, the federal government, we have statutes that need 6.371 to make the same sort of policy in this state for any refunds from people in power. But we need to take the actual issue about, speaking of the separation in your arguments. This is the oldest state. What it's about, really, for yourself, when it improves the time of term. Testing with the food and the term. I don't know how much more legislation you have. And you're sitting down and having to find this term, work your whole class for 3 years. You certainly believe that more than five for the law, that's why we have to see 36.60 or for the road tax, we want to charge $36 in total here. To make sure that absolutely no one ever argued that this was some kind of fairly issue to respect to. Maybe we lost it. But when you call it in the process of 196.371,
Counsel, I kind of understand your argument. This is a follow up to Justice Prosser's question. It's hypothetical about filing a for the benefit of the Badgers or something. It's if I understand your argument, it is that as long as you properly filed the rate, then the Public Service Commission cannot order you to do a refund. Is that correct?
Yes, Public Service Commission itself. There could be other rules under the statute, which presents a conduct
That's the essence of it. It's only you properly filed the leave, even though it has been subsequently determined to be unlawful, that there is no authority to order a refund.
Correct.
What is the purpose of these statutes? I need help with this. You mentioned through all of this regulatory authority, of course, the GTE case, and one of the main cases in this set. The purpose is to protect consumer public. And of course, these are remedial statutes that are being liberally construed in order to affect them. How can not being able to order a refund be consistent with the purpose of protecting the consumer public if you've had an unlawful, determined to be unlawful?
I think I'm looking at the politics, which is this whole point, 3.2 in the GTE case, and we agree with that. But after section 2.372, where you're talking about it, it's a kind of public policy that section 2.2 protection of the remnants of the utility we still have. And it seems to me quite clear that if you go back to 186.86, if they want to refund the authority, because there are other avenues to it, but if they wanted to give the PSC refund authority, they would have done so. You could have started to look at, for example, 195, and I'm going to give you some sketches of 195.371, which is the railroad commission sketch. It's got the municipal water system. And in both cases, the PSC or the legislature said, we would need the power to actually refund anything over an unreasonable or an illegal rate. And so clearly, we have to request the power to do 371.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Please, the court. I'm Diane Ramsey. I represent the Public Service Commission. The commission determined that an unlawful rate of the TPSI can never be properly filed. The Senator Bill's argument minimizes the fact that the TPSI violated the Post Club Law. Just like the old adage, one can be a little bit pregnant, an unlawful rate can be a little bit illegal.
Counsel, isn't your argument proof too much because aren't the rates that were talked about in the cases that opposing counsel cites also rates that PSC determined were unlawful but still did not order a rollback?
In the cases that counsel cited, such as Wisconsin Power and Light and Kimberly Clark, the rates, for example, Wisconsin Power and Light, the rates have been approved as legal for about 14 years. And the issue became whether the rate was unreasonable with the passage of time and change of circumstances.
But doesn't that unreasonableness make it also unlawful?
It does.
And so to go back to the argument you just made to us, that an unlawful rate can never be properly filed, would include at the time in the place the PSC made that determination that it was also unlawfully filed.
Well, our focus is at the time that the TPSI was filed, it was unlawful. It never should have been charged in the first place. In contrast to Wisconsin Power and Light, where the utility had a right to rely on that rate and the revenue, and the consumers had a right to rely on the rate because it was lawful at the time.
But the intention is something that becomes unlawful over a period of time will be treated differently under the statutes than one that was unlawful at the moment was filed.
Yes. Well, the Kimberly Clark was talking about becoming unlawful over time.
Okay.
The Kimberly Commission was unlawful. That is the law of this case because the Court of Appeals upheld the Commission's determination of its unlawfulness. This Court is going to review the issue. And I have an example to illustrate why the charge that violates a statutory prohibition from inception can never be properly filed. So it's a little unlawful rape in a different context, both more familiar than post-death law and access charges. Let's say a residential customer expected a local phone call to be billed by volume or a flat rate or a combination, but they did not expect to be billed on how long the call is. And that reasonable expectation because chapter 1 prohibits billing local calls based on duration of the call. Let's say a major telecommunications provider like Wisconsin Bell filed a tariff for local service billings that charge based on duration of the call. When they did in the filing bill system, the Pixie listing, we would be billed under the tariff for 6 months. There's no question but that charge never could have been imposed in the first place, and there are no rights to collect revenue from the charge that violated Chapter 186. The implication of Wisconsin's argument here is that the utility can keep charging the tariff for the local service until after the commission in a contested case hearing issues an order stopping them, and then the utility can keep the revenues because the commission has followed this order of refund. Consumers will be left to separately pursue refunds through separate court actions. This is why a charge that violates the provision in the statute from inception cannot be properly filed.
The cost of the argument be charged in this case was void as opposed to voidable. Is that what you mean by
that? It was void from the beginning. And it could not be reimbursed or reset because it was unlawful entirely.
So in other words, the reason that 196.371 will not be swallowed by two is that the distinction is, as Justice Butler indicated, the void voidable or it was unlawful at the beginning. In other words, the distinction basically is that maybe you can give me an example of one where two would not apply and one would allow something to be filed in the future. Can you?
To preface that, I think that 196.37 reflects two different principles. Paragraph 1 reflects certainty and rates because public utilities need to be able to rely on lawful rates, and adjusting the rates retroactively would upset the balance.
Just so I understand, as opposing counsel pointed out, here after an investigation, after you found a rate to be unjust and reasonable or unlawful, then that's the example I want where it would not fall under where it was unlawful at the beginning. That's exactly what you're giving.
Basically, as an example, let's say energy utility, looking at the typical rate-making case under paragraph 1, an energy utility wants to implement rates charging for electrical services. They would file the rates with the commission and go through a rate proceeding. They would notice to the public and the commission would approve the rates as lawful and as the amount would be approved as reasonable. And let's say over a period of years, their operating costs fluctuate with the economy and go up. And after the operating costs go down, and so that the utility is making more profit than expected at the time that the commission approved the rates. That rate, 2 years down the line, could be seen as unreasonably high. And unfortunately, consumers, because the electric utility is less operating costs. Paragraph 1 allows the commission to go back in, revisit the rate, and adjust it prospectively, and prohibit the commission from going back retroactively because the public and the utility both needed to rely on that rate.
I thought under the new regulation, 1884, up to this date, that a utility could set well, through the rate. And what you're saying, if the rate was not unlawful at the inception,
correct,
then you could not go back. But they have the right, don't they, under the new regulation, to go ahead and set a rate, providing they go through all of the requirements.
Right, under the base camp law, which is a major law that you're regulating the telecommunications industry, the utility that opts to price that regulation for access rates, the utility is not to go through the traditional process of filing rates and having them approved. The goal of the access rate provision in the price cap law was to reduce access rates and promote long-distance competition. The concern of the company is that the company has no cap on its revenues. There's often not guaranteed revenue, but there's no cap on the revenue, and there's no cap on the overall cost. The drawback, as opposed to the company, is that they have to make sure those rates are lawful at the time they're filed, because it is, they can't rely on the traditional process.
They do that. Here, well, if you had your staff attorneys look at this, based on what I read, and they apparently either okayed it or said that they didn't see any problem. So what do you have to have a full hearing before, basically, to protect yourself? You really couldn't do this.
Well, with the couple things, the company under this new law is really in no different position than any other large business that's deregulated and has to comply with complex laws like tax laws. And a large utility like Wisconsin Valley doesn't have the technical and legal resources to look at the lawfulness of what it's charging. Secondly, if the utility wants to request a declaratory ruling under 227.41 as to whether the charge is lawful.
Well, they could have gotten the, in other words, the argument here is that, well, look, for three and a half years, this went along, and we had no idea that we thought what we did was lawful. And you're saying that they could have gotten a declaratory ruling.
Yes, they could.
And then if they're going through the whole rate making process and you really get rid of the efficiencies that the legislature tried to put through, and they did 196.196 to begin
with. I think it would be a fallback position, but in this case there were questions almost immediately about the lawfulness of the picking, and that may have been the signal to request the declaratory ruling that get the protection that an approved rate has.
Your staff okay initially that this was not a problem, and then in the formal action, 2 or 3 years later, the PSC took a formal position that in fact it was not a lawful rate. So really, utilities are a little bit silly operating under this. They either have to get a declaratory ruling or they should use the old rate making process. That way they're protected because it will be okay by the PSC. But then you can go 196.196 out of statute, don't you?
No.
You don't want to use it. I mean,
that usually is structured as part of the regulating the industry. With the staff's initial investigation, that was very much a partial investigation in the revenue hearing.
Well, I can understand all of that, but it just seems that if in fact the PSC can order rollbacks, is fraught with problems for a utility that chooses to use it if the legislature wanted this process to increase competition. I'm thinking to reconcile what I thought the legislature was doing and looking at it from the utility's perspective on the time that it goes up in the door.
Well, from the utility's perspective or from the commission's perspective, they do need to do the research and make sure that their rates are compliant with the law. In this case, there was a specific statutory prohibition that Carrier Panel Monitor was prohibited, and that was spelled out in 1996.
The whole argument about whether this was a substitute for that charge, and there wasn't any case law on that, and there hadn't been any litigation before the PSC on that, right? So they were really litigating with the PSC And the PSD was saying, well, this is what the statute means, and you have to wait for it. But up until this point in time, there was no way they would know.
Well, the PSD did collect common law revenues, carry common law revenues, and he implemented a charge that collected a payment or tariff of carrier common law revenues. That should have said the statement that, you know, we're getting close to what's being prohibited here.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Can the PSC set an unlawful rate?
The PSC basically realized that the PSC made a mistake. In the traditional rate case, the commission hears from the public and the utility. And if there's competitors, and takes in testimony from all the different sources and analyzes it and does a good job to determine the rate that's reasonable between the public and the utility. It's getting very complex and difficult, whether it's using the telecommunications.
But let's just assume the commission sets an unlawful rate and the whole assumption. And it's taken to court. What powers does the PSC have to undo that unlawful rate?
If the commission sent a rate back there, it is completely unlawful, if the utility never should have collected a denial under the rate, there should be reasonable authority under GTE. And paragraph 2 of 196.37. If the rate is too high or low, the need for certainty prevails. And then we're looking at paragraph 1, because what the commission was doing was acting in this quasi legislative fashion and basically issuing a rule between the customers and the utility. Then there's a need to live with that rate and adjust it in the future.
Looking at your enforcement authorities under sub 2, as I understand, that's where you order the refunds, right?
Yes.
Which measurement regulation, practice, act, or service did the PSC determine to be unjust in this case?
The imposing of the unlawful charge on collecting revenue was an unlawful practical act.
The imposing of the unlawful charge, to kind of paraphrase this question argument, was the issue of rates, doesn't it?
The charge was still already correct.
And if it goes to the issue of rates, why wouldn't, using basic statutory analysis, the specific control over the general?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last year.
Specific statute dealing with rates is sub 1. This government report is nothing about rates is sub 2.
Paragraph 1 really deals with compensation for the utility. The words in paragraph 1 all deal with rates, toll, charges, schedules. It's not, it's designed to allow the commission to adjust those rates to make them reasonable and lawful. As opposed to paragraph 2, particularly with interpretable GTE, will address unlawful acts or practices. In other words, paragraph 2 is a broader scope to deal with a rate that's flat out unlawful.
Is your interpretation of 196.37.2 in GTE case?
We are following the GTE case in our interpretation of this case in the authority of the commission. And also the words of paragraph 2, we have the advisory words, it's broader than one.
If you're looking at the words of paragraph 2, what about that followed in the future that is repeated in paragraph 1 and paragraph 2? Doesn't that have the same effect in paragraph 2 as it's been interpreted to have in paragraph 1?
We're following the language of the GTE case where this court said that the language is intended broad remedial authority, and that allowed the authority to order a refund if the order is against a reasonable order. But I want to add that paragraph 1, and this may have been questioned before, also does not apply here. because the commission doesn't have authority to set or review the Dixie under the Price Cap Law. So the Dixie was never amenable to paragraph one in the start. That's why the remedial authority in part would come from paragraph two.
One question on GTE. The opposing council seems to try to distinguish GTE on the fact that basically you were talking about not properly tariff. In other words, the rates were not properly tariff. And he says that we were talking about services clearly fell under 186.37.2. In your response to that is because they're the facts were different with GTE than they are here.
We said that they're clearly in the report with GTE because we have a charge that virtually then goes to this place. The charge of GTE was on tariff and violated the five-year doctrine in 196.2. The charge here violated the price cap law.
Do you have any authority prior to the GTE case's interpretation of that subsection 2 where the PNC imposed refunds?
I did not find any case law from the appellate courts interpreting subsection 2. The GTE was the first major case upon subsection 2. What about Century Tel? Century Tel followed GTE, and we believe that this case is also consistent with Century Tel. And the charge in Century Tel was unlawful because the company of utility did not go through the traditional rate making process. And the actual charge there should not have been imposed in the first place.
GTE basically interpreted the language that would be repealed. This is a it was 1993 case law.
Correct.
It was in 1983 session that the language repealed. So basically, we're looking back in time and interpreting language as a repeal to create a refund authority and then sort of just skipping over language in the future. That's what you're allowing your authority to do this?
GTE is precedent for precedent on the interpretation of 1996-37, and the court indicated that the language allowing for refund had been mistakenly omitted in the revision of that section. And the court looked to the intent of the legislature for paragraph 2. And in GTE, indicated that we supposed to provide this individual authority.
Counsel, in GTE, was that language at the bottom that bothers me, followed in the future part of the statute?
Yes, it was. The statutes have been in this. This wording in both the paragraphs has been in place for many years.
It seems to me that the statute says, introduction of whatever that act was in 1983, that they didn't run any policy. But in fact, in the whole history of the Service Commission, there's never been policy on refunds because that seems to be a retroactive rate. Why is it suddenly the whole policy is changing off the rest?
I don't think the policy was changed. The retroactive refunds means going back and readjusting the rate. It's like Monday morning quarterbacking. In a case where a rate is completely unlawful, the rate can't be readjusted. There's nothing there to be readjusted. It has to be voided. And a refund doesn't amount to retroactive refund. It doesn't affect the issues of certainty that are needed for lawful rates. And so the fairness between the fixed and refund, the utilities here and the consumer long distance companies in a position where you then have the charge not been imposed.
All of your aides in the Fundamental Needs 6372 benefit of authority to refund?
No. The last point is the language of 196-186-2A authorized institution to enforce the subsection. In the context of the Christian law of pure implication, enforced to refund because it is putting the utilities back in the position that they're then the unlawful charge has been imposed. This is a major section of the Christian law. The goal is to reduce access charges. The term enforces only within the Christian law, only subsection 2 has the term enforced. And our position is that that is a reasonable interpretation of the term enforced.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. My name is Stephen Chiong with the law firm of Ryan Edward Van Buren. I represent two of the three interchange carriers, Sprint Telecommunications and Cell. Hartland Astor from Fisher Ford and Franklin Northeast with AT&T. I think when you step back and look at what the commission is doing here, you get a very clear read on the difference between 196.37.1 and 196.37.2. And that is precisely what the entire governance court, and that is what was the commission doing here. The commission was not contrary to the repetitive use of the word rate. State law is saying how much can Wisconsin bill charge, but what the Living Commission's authority. At any time that was not in the commission's authority, they could not say you have to charge this. Rather, the commission looked and proved that it was brought by the interchange carrier that was initiated by the interchange carrier to say, was it or was it not a carrier common line charge? And what they did, as the court was talking about earlier, was they gave up the right to charge any kind of carrier common line charge in 1994 when they opted for this new system. And what they also gave up, under the package argument, is guaranteed revenue, guaranteed profit. That's a throwback. The rate of return of it is they gave up. And so the reality here is the commission did not say you can charge, you can charge. They said you can't charge anything. And the argument that was submitted on which the entire personnel brief and position was focusing on how the commission negated this portion of the 15 tariff. It set the rate to zero. When I count the children, you can't add in cooking. That needs to be added, period. It's not how many cookies can you add. Well, we can't do it if we have an increase in it. No, we can't do that. The commission didn't have the authority here to do anything other than give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to what this charge was. And because the charge was standing for a prohibited, illegal, prohibited, it was unlawful from its beginning, and it was intact. And again, I'd like your attention to 196.37.2. It was intact of finding a tariff with a charge. We're not talking about the reason for it. We're not talking how much, which is what 196.37.1 would look at. Instead, we're looking at, is this a fish or a fowl? Is this a carrier coming on the charge or is it? If it's not, that's the end of the discussion. The captain bell can charge it, add in tonight. But because it was illegal, because the legislature said, you can't do this. If you accept the you're free of it, your lawyers aren't, there's no governor by way of return rate. You're jumping into the marketplace and you can, you know, cut jobs and utilize and be efficient, you can make more money. We're not going to put the site. That's what they opted for. But by doing that, they gave up the very thing that they're saying we should have right now.
What is your authority for the refund?
The reason
Supreme Court, Your Honor, is the language of an interpretation of this court of 19672, and I did put open to the EGD North case. And specifically, by the question, I think this was Constitution 6, where they were, this court was talking, first, we're starting the motion, this is a reading that it needs to be included in vote. To give it back, to make sure the commission has the ability to protect the suit. And the court before looked at the multi-agency language, and also the work of the legislature's intention that this change was not going to create any substantive procedural law. And they thought, where the phrase implement some other order respecting such measurement related to hand practice or service, that should be present reasonable. The challenge is identified by language, and that the institutional language did modify it. So that's good to know that.
You think subsection 1 authorizes refunds?
No, I don't. Well, subsection 1 does, and not exactly what you need to look at again. The type of decision, this was a constitutional subsection 2, which was not, looking at what the commission was doing, we have to go on to focus on our investigation. We have to focus on what was the nature of this proceeding. This is subsection 2.7 proceeding. So, again, the only two proceedings, it was a competitive class. A class who has a case proceeding, and they weren't focusing on how much. If they did it, they reset the rates and say, well, you don't charge half, or no, you have to go back to the rate that you were charging before you up in 98 or 99, whatever it was. That would violate 137. But that's not what they did here. They didn't say, well, the bad news on that. We're going to fly, if you will, use the football comment. You can't do this.
Well, can I understand your argument correctly? What you're saying is that if they hadn't had a strict charge on, they had the rate structured the same way they had in 97, which gave them the same overall zero, the PSC couldn't have the 70 this statute, but it could have said it's too high. But they couldn't have the same zero. Roll
back,
but they would have had to say, take a
lesser number? Yeah, I'm not saying that. What they could do is they could not review an aspect rate. That's what 196, 192 A says.
Right.
They can't do that. No, what I'm saying is that the commission could not do it and did not clear how much. The commission said, this is. They have to be an inventory function. What is it? Is it carrier common line charge? The legislature said you have to give that up. Wisconsin Bell didn't do that.
Okay, I understand the argument.
I'm
sorry. Why do you need a good analogy with your cookies? So I understand where you are. And what I'm trying to look at is this can be used with other businesses. And what I'm trying to figure out is what you're telling me is if you don't have something that is a prohibited type of charge, so you can say, this, you can't have this element in your zero. If the PSC reviews it, they can't make an order to somehow reduce something else that was a type of charge that you could have that was just too high.
I want to be clear that wrong. They can. And this is consistent with the Kimberly Clark case. They can reach out a rate, but they can't do that. They can't order a refund. They can't do the retroactive rate. They can just conceptually power by the rate before.
The only reason you think it can occur here is there's a cumulative charge that was prohibited, not whatever the amount was, but that it was a cumulative charge. Okay.
Why didn't you folks go out to the tribal governments?
I think you just heard
25 or 30 years. There's a lot of criminal development in 6.37. That's a good way to have to overcome. And somehow there is a hole in the law. We don't believe that there is no community. But I think it is for us to talk to a little bit too warm or a little bit too cool, kind of like Goldilocks. Discrimination is a little too much or a little too old. Discrimination is discrimination. Unlawfulness is unlawfulness. The broad terms of fashion, Goldilocks, in the GTE case, they were, I agree with that process, but I don't know. Necessarily think that yourself from all of the people who look at the prior language in the statute, which has to be a person who can believe that language has never been in 186.371. And the solution says that we can have a bit of a rising to price what we told it. What do you want in 6.87 that we don't follow the provisions of 186.371? It didn't repeal that statute for us, and we get to a legal point. If it really meant that the power of curriculum in the statute, and giving that power, why didn't they do it in 186.86?
I'm very troubled with the GD case. I think it's.
In both those cases, you really look at what's going on.
We could all post these issues.
Secretary Powell also. The great love of the idea. This question made us, they didn't file. They didn't file issues. So if we're not characterized that as an act, that we're not investing money so that we, really didn't follow the proper procedures for doing so, the whole issue in this case is substantive. So there are 20 realities
under the circumstances we're here. But the public policy is very really important. You know, we're seeing the record of destruction in the state. Obviously, we know that all these cases in the state is going through a huge impact change. And it's not in my mind. You know, I would say that that public policy about voting certainty is, if it's not more of a vote, it's going to make this case clear.
Thank you. That completes the case. The court is going to give a driving refresh, one for the